From Democracy Now in Exile, this is the War and Peace Report. How many innocent Afghan civilians has the U.S. killed? According to a Democracy Now! Exclusive, over 3,500. Is it payback time? The number of casualties in Afghanistan has surpassed the number of dead at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Also, a rally for Mumia Abu-Jamal in Philadelphia is attacked. 7 people are arrested, charged with felony assault. 3 demonstrators are hospitalized.
Guns drawn, billy clubs, and mace, police attacked the peaceful demonstration for Mumia Abu-Jamal on the 20th anniversary on Saturday.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-Taliban forces launched a 3-pronged ground attack today on eastern Afghanistan's White Mountains. A senior anti-Taliban officer said U.S. planes had quit bombing to avoid hitting their allies on the ground. American warplanes accidentally killed 3 Mujahideen fighters in the region on Saturday night. It was the 3rd so-called friendly fire incident in 8 days. Meanwhile, disagreements between Mujahideen commanders at the front boiled over in a tense confrontation in which soldiers from rival groups brandished their guns and took up firing positions in front of one another's headquarters. 2 senior Taliban defectors were among 20 people killed in a helicopter crash in northern Afghanistan on Saturday. The 2 were renowned ethnic Pashtun leaders. Supporters believe the Northern Alliance deliberately crashed the helicopter to kill the leaders. The alliance says it was an accident. The Bush administration says that U.S. military forces are CIA personnel working in Jalalabad have discovered a videotape of Osama bin Laden. They say that the tape shows bin Laden recounting how he listened to news reports on the radio of the first plane crashing into the Pentagon. And quickly told others around him there will be more as he awaited the second attack. They say the tape also shows bin Laden admitting that many of the hijackers apparently had not known they were on suicide missions. But a debate has broken out within the administration on whether to release the video. Many in the White House argue that it will bolster the case to the Arab world that bin Laden planned the attacks and portray him as cold-blooded. Others say that many in the Arab world would find the discovery of the tape too convenient and charge that it was a creation of the CIA and Hollywood collaborators. A senior official admitted that the tape's quality is not good and that the images are dark. A final decision on the video will be taken by Karen Hughes, President Bush's close advisor, who leads a communications unit jointly set up by Britain and America to conduct the public relations war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Afghanistan's new interim leader, Hamid Karzai, claims he brokered successful talks between 2 rival factions in the city of Kandahar yesterday morning. The city has been overtaken by infighting just days after it fell to anti-Taliban forces. 2 rival commanders are in control of separate sections of the city. The road to the city is said to be littered with dead bodies and the remains of smashed cars. Aid agencies say there are already 15 checkpoints set up by rival groups. Several aid convoys passed through, but all said they were robbed of their humanitarian supplies. The Israeli army launched a nighttime raid on the Arab village of Anabta, shooting dead 4 policemen, setting fire to 1 house and dynamiting another, arresting several dozen residents. Residents said soldiers forced men from the village to strip to their underwear and stand in the street while the buildings were searched. Several men showed their hands, on which their names and house numbers had been written in indelible ink by their interrogators, red for suspects' families, green for the neighbors of suspects. The UN Human Rights Commissioner Mary Robinson criticized the Bush administration plan to set up military tribunals, saying that they skirt democratic guarantees. She said the safeguards, including the right to a fair trial, must be upheld even in crisis. After a heated New York City Council hearing on Thursday and angry protests by one of New York's largest unions, the Giuliani administration has decided to scrap plans to hire the Bechtel Group to take over control of the World Trade Center cleanup. The announcement came this weekend after more than 4 weeks of secret negotiations and seemed to surprise the San Francisco multinational corporation. Had it won the contract, the company stood to earn as much as $27.5 million from the deal. Bechtel has a history of botched construction projects, poor labor practices, forced privatization of public industries, particularly in developing countries. It's also known for its generous contributions to Republican candidates and its close ties to GOP leaders. And independent reporter Robert Fisk was beaten up days ago in Afghanistan. He writes in today's Independent, "They started by shaking hands. We said, 'Salam alaikum, peace be upon you.' Then the first pebbles flew past my face. A small boy tried to grab my bag, then another. Then someone punched me in the back. Then young men broke my glasses, began smashing stones into my face and head. I couldn't see for the blood pouring down my forehead and swamping my eyes, and even then I understood. I couldn't blame them for what they were doing. In fact, if I were the Afghan refugees of Qila Abdullah, close to the Afghan-Pakistan border, I would have done just the same to Robert Fisk or any other Westerner I could find." Fisk goes on to say, "So why record my few minutes of terror and self-disgust under assault near the Afghan border, bleeding and crying like an animal, when hundreds, let us be frank and say thousands, of innocent civilians are dying under U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan, when the, quote, war of civilization is burning and maiming the Pashtuns of Kandahar and destroying their homes because good must triumph over evil?" This is the War and Peace Report.
A lot of people write songs about wars and government, very social things. But I think about young guys who were like I was when I was young. I had no more idea about any government or political things or anything. And I think about those kind of young guys now who all of a sudden somebody comes up. And they're very law-abiding. So if somebody says go, they don't ask any questions, they just go. And I can remember not too long ago seeing a young guy with his right arm gone. Just got back. And I asked him how he was doing. He said he was doing all right now, but he had thought he was gonna die. He said getting shot at didn't bother him. It was getting shot that shook him up. And I tried to put myself in his position. Maybe he cried. Maybe he said, "I can't write left-handed. Would you please write a letter to my mother? Tell her to tell, tell her to tell, tell her to tell her family lawyer. Trying to get a deferment for my younger brother. Tell the Reverend Harris to pray for me, Lord, Lord, Lord. I don't believe I'm gonna live to get much older."
You've been listening to "I Can't Write Left-Handed," classic concert, Bill Withers live at Carnegie Hall. Here on the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive on the casualties in Afghanistan. We're going to start with a piece written by Richard Lloyd Perry, wrote in last week's Independent from Kama Adu, Afghanistan. Richard Lloyd Perry writes, quote, "The village where nothing happened is reached by a steep climb at the end of a rattling 3-hour drive along a stony road. Until nothing happened here early on the morning of Saturday and again the following day, it was a large village with a small graveyard, but now that has been reversed. The cemetery on the hill contains 40 freshly dug graves, unmarked and identical, and the village of Kama'adu has ceased to exist. Many of the homes here are just deep conical craters in the earth. The rest are cracked open, split like crushed cardboard boxes. At the moment when nothing happened, the villagers of Kama'adu were taking their early morning meal before sunrise and the beginning of the Ramadan fast. And there in the rubble, dented and ripped, are tokens of the simple daily lives they led. A contorted tin kettle, turned almost inside out by the blast. A collection of charred cooking pots and the fragments of an old-fashioned pedal-operated sewing machine. A split metal chest contains scraps of children's clothes and cheap, bright nylon. In another room are the only riches that these people had, 6 dead cows lying higgledy-piggledy and distended by decay. And all this is very strange because on Saturday morning, when American B-52s unloaded dozens of bombs that killed 115 men, women, and children, nothing happened. We know this because the U.S. Department of Defense told us so. That evening, a Pentagon spokesman questioned about reports of civilian casualties in eastern Afghanistan explained they were not true because the U.S. is meticulous in selecting only military targets associated with Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. Subsequent Pentagon utterances on the subject have wobbled somewhat, but there has been no retraction of that initial decisive statement. It just didn't happen. And that was only one bombing run on one day. With the Pentagon claims and the mainstream media white out here in the U.S., it's been extremely difficult to get a picture of just how many civilians the U.S. has killed. Well, one professor has done something about it. Since the bombing started on October 7th, a professor at the University of New Hampshire has scoured newswires and major newspapers from all over the world, combined this information with firsthand accounts, and has just put it all together in a single report. Today, Professor Mark Herold releases his findings in a Democracy Now! in Exile exclusive. Since October 7th, over 3,500 civilians have been killed in Afghanistan by U.S. bombs, surpassing the number of people believed to have been killed at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th. Mark Herold joins us now from the University of New Hampshire. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. First, can you tell us how you came up with the figure that you have at this point?
What I did is I looked at all the possible foreign newspaper accounts, news stories, first-hand accounts reported by news agencies from Pakistani news agencies to Reuters, Agence France-Presse. I consulted reports written by NGOs. There's a Italian medical team in Kabul and north of Kabul, which has kept chronicles day by day. So it's been an enormous job, about 14 hours a day for the last 5 weeks. The total count, which I have and is available publicly, is 3,767, which works out to be about 62 per day.
Now, we haven't gotten any reports like this in the mainstream media. Can you take a particular day and describe how you compiled a number?
I could take a number of days. They're all here. Why don't we take, to start, let's take October 15th, which was not a particularly bad day. But on October 15th, the capital city, Kanau, was bombed in an overnight attack. 12 civilians reported dead. This is reported in Arab News, Pakistan Observer, and various other places. On the same day, the main power station in Kabul, located in the northeast of Kabul, was hit. 12 civilian casualties. This knocked electricity out for 2 days with serious consequences for hospitals. This was reported in the Times of India, BBC News, the Frontier Post. A hospital and homes were hit in Kandahar. They were strafed by AC-130s. 5 people were killed who were seeking treatment. And there are three or four other incidents, including the last one. A cruise missile landed in Pakistan, in Spingarh, in a shepherd village, killing sheep and goats. And that was just on one day. And I have data here for 61 days.
Can you talk about the range of targets of the U.S. bombing?
The range is amazing. What I want to be clear about here is sort of what I'm saying and what I'm not saying. I am not saying that the U.S. Bombing attack targeted civilian areas. That is not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that the decision to knock out what were deemed military targets had serious consequences in terms of civilian casualties. Now, to answer your question, the range is enormous. One of the preferred targets has been fuel trucks. We actually have video footage of convoys of fuel trucks coming in from Iran and going down the highway from Herat to Kandahar being attacked by fighter planes. Mosques have been hit. Hospitals have been hit. The Red Crescent Clinic has been hit. Taxis have been hit. A very serious incident took place in Tarin-Kot, which is the capital of Uzurgan province, where a tractor and trailer carrying refugees was hit. Residential areas have been hit. The largest power station with the largest hydroelectric facility in Afghanistan, the Kajakai Dam power station, was hit. The list is literally endless of targets which have been either directly targeted as sort of what the Pentagon calls targets of opportunity or military targets.
We're talking to Professor Mark Harold, a professor of at the University of New Hampshire, who has very methodically, from the time of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, gone through day by day scores of newspapers and other reports to collate the figures on how many people have died in Afghanistan. His figures at this point are over 3,700. This has not been of interest to the mainstream media. Can you talk about that, the lack of questions asked about casualties in Afghanistan, Professor Harold?
Well, I think it's been part of a really very concerted effort on the part on behalf of the State Department and the Pentagon, and regrettably, the corporate media has gone along with this to keep the story of civilian casualties away from American screens, newspapers, and magazines. There's plenty of evidence to support that statement from the Pentagon buying up all the commercial satellite imagery, which was available to everyone as of October 11th, after a very serious bombing incident in Darunta in the province of Jalalabad. All the images once available by the Iconos satellite system were bought up. The sending of Secretary Powell to Qatar to scold the Al Jazeera news reporting bureau for the reports coming directly from Kabul. Incidentally, the Al-Qatar offices in Kabul were also hit by a missile in mid-November. And the hiring of very high-paid public relations experts to basically present the war to the American people, or as I like to put it, market the war to the American people. There's ample evidence to show, I think, that this has been part of a very concerted effort to keep the carnage off the screens of RTV and off the front pages of our newspapers. Occasionally, one reads a report on civilian casualties on page 20 or page 35 or something of that sort. And I think this is part of the program to marshal public support for this war effort, which is the, as I like to call it, the fourth Afghan war. Afghanistan has had four wars in the recent century.
Professor Harold, we're going to do more with you on this Democracy Now! Exclusive reporting on the number of casualties at this point in our second hour. But last question, that is, have the number of killings escalated, accelerated in the last week with the massive bombing of Tora Bora and Jalalabad?
That's really interesting. The answer to that is no, not really. There have been three stages, really, in the air war. The first stage lasted about 3 weeks, and this consisted in destroying Taliban military facilities, or what were deemed to be military facilities, mostly in urban areas. The Taliban did not have large military bases, but rather had a large number of smaller facilities spread across the country. And this was one of the reasons why the civilian count in the first 3 weeks, the death count in the first 3 weeks, was really quite high, because what was happening was that aircraft and cruise missiles were hitting urban areas where Taliban had small garrisons and where government buildings existed and so on. The second phase of the air war was literally the old traditional blunderbusses of the skies, the B-52s, bombing Mazar-i-Sharif, Kunduz, and Khanabad, where large numbers of people died because they lived in small villages, mud hut villages on the front line. And so you had a few very, very days of very, very high casualty figures. And the most recent times, what you referred to, is what's really been happening in the last 2 or 3 weeks, where after the Taliban retreated, and we had the carpet bombing around Kandahar and in the mountains east of Jalalabad. And as well, and this is, I think, very important, the bombing of what the Pentagon likes to call targets of opportunity, which basically meant anything moving on the streets and highways in the southern provinces of Helmand, Kandahar, and a few other provinces in that area. It was simply dangerous to be in a taxi, a truck, a bus, a car, anything during these recent times. So what we have is really different types of areas and which are being bombed over the course of the last 60 days. So the answer to your question is no. In fact, the highest counts were really in the early days, where we had persistently 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 people a day being killed.
Well, Professor Mark Harold, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Again, we're going to have you with us in our second hour to continue this conversation as you break the sound barrier, bringing us the reports of the number of Afghan civilians who've been killed since the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan began. The figure you have at this point, again, is more than 3,700 people. Again, the number surpassing the number of believed dead at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th. Professor Mark Harold is a professor of economics and women's studies at the Whittemore School of Business and Economics at the University of New Hampshire. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to find out what happened in Philadelphia this weekend when more than 600 people marched on the 20th anniversary of the incarceration of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Stay with us.
Fighting for survival.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report, Buffalo Soldier, Bob Marley and the Wailers from the CD Confrontation. On December 9th, 1981, 20 years ago, journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal was driving a cab through the streets of Philadelphia. He drove up to the corner of 13th and Locust, where he says he saw a police officer, Daniel Faulkner, beating up his brother, William Cook. What happened next is not clear, but what's undisputed is both Mumia Abu-Jamal and the officer, Daniel Faulkner, were shot. Faulkner then died. What's in dispute is who killed the police officer. Mumia Abu-Jamal says it was someone else, and several witnesses say they saw another shooter flee the scene. Mumia's legally registered .38 was never decisively linked to Faulkner's wounds. When the police arrived on the scene, they found Mumia Abu-Jamal. He was beaten up. They charged him with murder. Abu-Jamal was sentenced to death in 1982. He's been on death row ever since. According to thousands of supporters around the world, the prosecution demanded the death sentence in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal because of his political beliefs. In 1995, Mumia Abu-Jamal was only 10 days away from execution when a worldwide outcry forced a stay of execution. On October 13, 1999, the Pennsylvania governor, Tom Ridge, who President Bush recently appointed to head, quote, Homeland Security, signed a new death warrant against Mumia Abu-Jamal. The federal judge has issued yet another stay of execution awaiting a habeas corpus petition filed by Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorneys in federal district court. Today, we're going to spend the rest of the program talking about his case because on Saturday, supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal were confronted by police in Center City, Philadelphia, during a rally marking the 20th anniversary of Abu-Jamal's arrest for the murder of police officer Daniel Faulkner. Police said seven Abu-Jamal supporters were arrested. We're going to turn first to one of the protesters who wound up in the hospital. We're joined on the telephone from Philadelphia by An Huynh, who is with International Concern Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Can you tell us what happened to you?
The ground by several police officers, and I don't remember much of what had happened. I remember passing out as I hit my head to the ground, and an officer had his knees on my chest, and at that point I couldn't breathe, and I passed out for a few seconds. And then I was immediately arrested, and then I requested to be sent to the hospital. So as soon as we were brought to the police station and found out that I had an injury to my tailbone and had suffered several contusions throughout my body.
Ao is one of more than 600 people who rallied in the streets of Philadelphia on Saturday. Police attacked the legally permitted demonstration. Two of those arrested were released without charges, but those not released have bonds ranging from $8,000 to $100,000. Most were charged with several counts of riot and assault. What were you charged with?
Not sure. I haven't spoken to my attorney to get a full explanation of exactly what I was charged with, but I believe I was charged with inciting riot, aggravated assault, failing to disperse, and several other charges.
Leslie Jones is also with us, an attorney and youth coordinator for International Concern Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Before we go to you, Leslie, what were you doing when the police moved in on you?
Myself?
Yes.
I was trying to observe what was happening because I had witnessed several of the protesters being dragged onto the ground and arrested. And at this point, I was on the sidewalk just trying to disperse and just remembering like police officers surrounding me, and I was shoved to the ground.
Leslie Jones, you've been watching these demonstrations for a while now. Were the police different on Saturday?
Yes, and I'll say good morning to your listeners, and thank you for having us. Saturday was definitely different. I've been doing Mumia organizing as a law student and as a Philadelphia resident for over 5 years, and we have never, ever before this, and since I've been around, had an experience like this. I think that this is definitely post-September 11th type of action, and we're not saying that this isn't the action that police have always wanted to take with us, but they have been restrained by the occurrences of Philadelphia prior to this, such as the bombing of the MOVE organization in 1985 and other such things, where the Philadelphia police have tried to show an air of civilized nature, we'll say, with their civil disobedience cops. They are, you know, they usually come dressed in suits and ties, and they wear an armband that says police. And their purpose is to intervene between the police and the demonstrators, those that come in a legally permitted protest to voice their complaints to the government. And what happened on Saturday, for me personally, when I saw the bike cops coming into the crowd and, you know, people starting to disperse, I ran forward, because I was at the very end of the march. I ran forward actually for several blocks to the very beginning of the march to let them know what was going on, because it had stretched out so. And one of the things, one of the main things that I noticed in running through the entire march to get to the front was that there were no civil affairs police officers around in that vicinity. And that is their role. That is their purpose. Where there is a problem, they are supposed to intervene. And these other, you know, beat cops or wherever they come from, in this case they brought in transit cops and all kinds of other police officers as well, they are not supposed to be the, you know, the line. It's supposed to be the civil affairs cops. The civil affairs cops were nowhere to be found, at least as much as what I saw and what several others saw. So that is a very big problem. A similar situation happened on August 17th when we were there for Mumia's Day in Court in front of Judge Denby, where you had, you know, people like Ozzie Davis, Jesse Jackson, Sonia Sanchez, the French delegation. You had so many people there, and Mumia was not there. When we were in the streets demonstrating, actually right near me, an incident started to break out with a bike cop again, and immediately civil affairs intervened. Of course, they tried to make it seem like it was something that the protesters were doing, and when in fact it was the bike cop that had started it, but they still intervened, and they still quashed the situation, where that was not what, you know, the case was on Saturday.
And the situation now for the people who've been arrested?
Well, the people that have been arrested in terms of making bail, which is the primary goal at this point, several people have thankfully been able to get out. And we, you know, we're happy about that. But we still have two people that are inside with a combined bail of $80,000. One has 30, one has 50. So we are desperately in need of people's support. Right now we are asking people who can wire money to do so, because we are, you know, in need of cash to get people out as soon as possible. And we're having people to wire money to a specific place in Philadelphia. I'm not sure if I can give you the phone number or how you want that to go out.
Yeah, you can give the phone number.
Okay, can wire money or send a check, you know, whatever they can do. The number to call is 610-394-0306. And definitely call, because when you wire money, you need to give specific information so that it can be, you know, properly identified and picked up. But we definitely need people who can donate, whether they can just do it as a loan or do it outright. We are in desperate need of funds here, because this situation came about in a very peculiar way. Like you mentioned before, this has not been the case in Philadelphia. I know in a lot of places where we've demonstrated, you know, police have been unleashed on the crowd. But Philadelphia, because of their history, of the brutal history of the Philadelphia police that dates back decades, you know, they are trying, as the city of quote-unquote brotherly love, to put out this air of, you know, we have cops under control.
Leslie,
Saturday we saw that wasn't the case.
Do you know what Au is charged with, who's had her tailbone fractured and has a sprained neck?
In all honesty, I don't know her exact charges. I know that several of them have, as she said earlier, the felony riot, conspiracy, and assault charges all mixed in, which would account for the high bail.
We're going to go to a commentary of Mumia Abu-Jamal now. This is a commentary that was recorded over the telephone, passed through the internet. It aired on Free Speech Radio News and today on the War and Peace Report.
The great British writer Aldous Huxley once said, "One of the great attractions of patriotism, it fulfills our worst wishes. In the person of our nation, we are able vicariously to bully and cheat. Bully and cheat, what's more, with a feeling that we are profoundly virtuous. In times of government and media declared war, elite pressures combine to compel people to express or reflect one's patriotism. The question immediately arises, what is patriotism? The love of country, love of one's people, or blind yielding obedience to government dictates? Is it the supine surrender of one's will to that of those in political power? Or is it the conviction that one must speak truth to power, yea, even unpopular, unheralded truth? Questions such as these are not easily answered, for there is no one single response. They're answered individually in the silence of the soul. How one answers depends where one is in national life and where one comes from. An American citizen elected to a high place in Congress dares to refuse to surrender her political independence to the nation's chief executive, urging caution as she casts a lone vote. She's threatened with death, not from foreign terrorists, but from domestic ones. A nationally known broadcaster announces that he is at the disposal of his commander-in-chief. Just tell me where to go, Mr. President, and I'm there, or worse to that effect, tears welling up in his stage makeup. Think about that. Consider, shall we say, those two extremes of public behavior. Which is more, well, patriotic? One retains her political independence, saying, in effect, I was not elected to surrender my powers to legislate to the executive, but to represent my constituency and the principle of separation of powers, without which democracy is illusory. The other publicly surrenders, saying, in effect, I will not pretend to objectivity. You are my commander, I am the commanded. My journalism is at your service, sire. The one is Congresswoman Barbara Jackson Lee, member of the House of Representatives of the 9th Congressional District, a Democrat from California. The other, of course, is CBS Network anchor Dan Rather, the multi-million-dollar unelected corporate journalist. Which is more popular?
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Which is more American? The U.S. Constitution has no provision, to my knowledge, for a national legislator to surrender her independence to the executive, even in times of war. As for the commander-in-chief reference, despite Dan's journalistic genuflection, the Constitution's Article 2 states that the president is commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States, and under certain circumstances, the militia. Unless Dan enlists, anchors aren't included. A free person is not patriotic because he surrenders his freedom. He's either free or he ain't. Which are you? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report, again, the 20th anniversary of the arrest of Mumia Abu-Jamal on December 9th, 1981. We are also joined in the studio by Courtney Anderson with International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the latest on his court case.
Okay, on November 21st, Judge Demby threw out the state petition for a new relief hearing for Mumia. Based on, she said that it was not her jurisdiction to rule on this, which was completely incredible because basically she had the lawyers file a lot of new briefs, file a lot of new material. She could have said it wasn't her jurisdiction in the first place.
And the main thrust of what the lawyers argued, the new argument for Mumia Abu-Jamal, what did they put forward in terms of a shooter in the case?
Okay, well, the new argument is that there is an actual man that confessed to shooting Faulkner. It's a highly credible confession. It explains a lot of the evidence in the prosecution's case that never made any sense. For example, there was a third blood type at the scene that they could never explain. Also, in Officer Faulkner's autopsy report, the medical examiner reported that there was a bruise on his left knee and his uniform was ripped, conducive with him falling to his knees. In the confession, Arnold Beverly actually states that he fell to his knees.
And where did he confess this?
He confessed it to Mumia's former attorneys, who sat on it, hit it.
And who was Arnold Beverly?
Arnold Beverly was a hitman who was hired by the Philadelphia police, corrupt fractions of the Philadelphia police, wanted Faulkner dead because he was an FBI informant into the police corruption.
So the state judge, Denby, heard this argument and then said it wasn't within her purview to rule on this and throughout the whole case. So it's now just going back to his last chance before a federal court.
Yes, but also they have filed, his new lawyers have filed a state Supreme Court appeal of that. But unfortunately, you know, that doesn't look great. And it's very important to note that she also said timeliness, that this should have come out when Wineglass and Williams first got it. And the fact that he confessed in 99, that they sat on it and hid that evidence, is now imperiling Mumia's life.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. Courtney Anderson of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leslie Jones, attorney, and Ao Hyun, who was arrested at the rally of more than 600 people on Mumia Abu-Jamal's behalf in Philadelphia on Saturday, her tailbone fractured and her neck sprained. She is charged with a number of other people in the protest. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, poet D'Lo, stay with us.
Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Let me hear you in the back. Clap your hands. Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Singing and praying, singing and praying with my mind stayed on freedom. Singing and praying with my mind stayed on freedom. Singing and praying with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. One more time. Singing and praying with my mind stayed on freedom. Singing and praying with my mind stayed on freedom. Singing and praying with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
The Judson Church Singers at an anti-sweatshop rally last week in New York. You are listening to War and Peace Report as we talk about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Again, on Saturday, more than 600 people gathered in the streets of Philadelphia to stop the execution of the African-American journalist, death row prisoner, to demand that his conviction be overturned and to call for him to be freed from death row. Police attacked the legally permitted demonstration. According to organizers, seven people were arrested with charges including felony assault and riot. Two of those arrested were released without charges or bail, but those not released have bonds ranging from $8,000 to $100,000. Three demonstrators were hospitalized with injuries, including a fractured tailbone, concussion, prolonged state of unconsciousness, internal bleeding, and severe abrasion. We now turn to one of the people who spoke out at a forum yesterday at New York University Law School, poet D'Lo.
Peace. 22 hours a day, cell box, for 20 years. This is dedicated to 20 years of resistance. Poking my head for a poem, I feel hopeless, like all the poems have been written, the songs all sung, the canvases all drawn on, the film all shot on. I ask the same spirits who give strength to him to give strength to me, to give back to him, to give back to me. And nothing. Imagine 22 hours in a cell box, day and night, bleeding into 20 years. Slowly. Nothing happens, or so it seems. Nothing changes except for maybe the worse. Imagine you were innocent. Imagine all that confusion. How do you get by? Imagine trying for 20 years. Scuffing my feet downtown, I feel the weight of this world, of New York City. My folks are depressed and scared, my eyes can't see clearly, and I put pen to paper only to feel more frustrated, praying for it all to get better or for it all to end. Remembering 99, when 9/11 was 9/11 was the national day of art for him, Mumia 9/11. Recalling how there were so many, too many, and still not enough poems, films, plays, and music peopled arm across the nation and internationally, inspired by him, his voice, his resistance. Remembering how I felt when I talked about the brother on death row, how I could feel the rawest form of hope for change, because I had faith in him, in his release. Because I looked at this caged bird and reveled at how high he could fly. How confined in a box, the sun still shined on him. How his wings shone brighter than any others. How these wings blind me to seeing clearly. Because confined in a box, he seemed the freest. Confused at how from within a covered cage, his call trumpets loudly, summoning us all. I want to understand. I don't want to imagine. I want to see. I want to see him free. I need to. I need to see how dope our front line will be. I need to understand freedom like he does. That they can lock you up, but they can never silence you. That the truth relies on hope in order to manifest. Imagine all you own in life is hope. Hope in the people. It is not unreasonable to believe in the human race. I want to believe like he does. Imagine when we take our horns, i.e. our voices, murals, poems, and songs to break these walls that are confining Mumia. Imagine all the new laws and rules fought with better armor, better skills, because we got hope on our side now. Imagine a freed Mumia. Peace.
Poet D'Lo, here on the War and Peace Report. Thank you, D'Lo. We're going to turn now to another of those who spoke yesterday at the Forum on Mumia Abu-Jamal at New York University Law School. He was Terry Bisson, and he has written a biography of Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is some of what he had to say.
Mumia wasn't always locked down quite as hard on death row, and there was a little window of time when he was in, I think it was Holmesburg Prison in Pennsylvania. He was there for one of his appeals, and I had a friend who was one of these hoary old SDS guys like Clark, who was in jail, and I went to visit him, and he said, "There's this guy here you've really got to meet." He says, and he said he's just this incredible guy, and they'd spent a lot of time together, and this is a very peculiar thing or an unusual thing for Mumia to get to actually hang out with other prisoners, but they hung out and then they became friends, and so that's how I got the privilege of being able to write to Mumia and work with him on a book or two and ended up being the person that got to write this book, which I'm very surprised that Francis didn't mention is one of the things that people can do, because at this point the money from the book actually goes to Mumia. He was generous enough to make sure that whatever I got for writing it, I got up front. So if you buy the book now, it's a great Christmas present, and it introduces people to the guy himself. I was a little, there's a lot of people who have read the book, but I would like to read a little short thing out of the book, simply because so many people had an experience with the cops in Philly yesterday. And when we talk about Mumia's 20 years of resistance, we have to remember that we're talking that 20 years ago, his orientation didn't change, his circumstances changed. He actually had already been he'd been in the face of the cops in Philly for quite a while before that. Mm-hmm. And the cops in Philly are, they have a particularity. They were really the Deep South, they were the up north version of the Deep South cops. Ritzo was really a Bull Connor type of, and this was not something that only Mumia knew about or only people in Philly. They were nationally very well known during the Nixon years as the toughest law and order type cops. So even though people have read the book, I just wanted to read a little short thing. And this little thing actually before Mumia was an activist. You got to go pretty far back in this guy's life. But wait, where the hell is it? Wesley Cook, this is who Mumia, this is before Mumia was Mumia. He was Wesley Cook. Was still in junior high at Stoddard Flesher when he first felt the winds of change sweep across North Philly. It was a cold fall day when a strange sound was heard above the mutterings of the teacher, who was patiently explaining how the Pilgrims and the Indians had been the best of friends. Friends? Really? Whatever. But, hey, listen. That strange shuffling sound was getting louder, resolving into footsteps. Footsteps and shouts. Then, right past the windows, marching and chanting, came hundreds and then thousands of students, all of them black, pouring down Broad Street from Penn and Bend, the high schools. Boys and girls alike, arms waving, fists punching the air. Black power rang up and down the street, tentative at first, then stronger and stronger. Black power, cried the boys. Black studies, cried the girls, always more studious. The adults looked on from the sidewalks, a little doubtful, some mistrustful, some envious, remembering their own youth when they had seized or let slip their own chance to change the world. The students marched on down toward the Board of Ed. This is a demonstration for a black studies program in the high schools. As they passed the baby schools, quotes, they drew the younger students with them like a magnet. A few at first, and then more and more defied their teachers, most of whom were puzzled but sympathetic, and drifted from the rooms, into the halls, into the streets. Wes was one of them, of course. He marched and chanted with the rest, but only for a few blocks. More pragmatic than political, as he describes himself in those days, Wes turned his feet toward home and took the rest of the day off. Frank Rizzo was, as usual, in his Cisco Kid mode that day. He was the police commissioner. He confronted the peaceful but large 3,000 students rally on the steps of the Board of Ed, his broad face as red as a baked ham. Then he shouted the order personally, "Get their black asses." Immediately, an army of cops charged into the crowd, nightsticks swinging. Soon the streets were echoing with the nightmarish thwack of oak clubs on young skulls, and the gutters were spattered with blood. Girl, boy, didn't matter to the men in blue. They were just kids, true, but they were black, and they were out of line. Dozens were injured, 15 hospitalized. Dozens more were charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. None of the police were ever charged or disciplined. Rizzo even denied that he had given an order to get their black asses until it was shown to him on video. Meanwhile, our hero was back at home in the PJs on the couch reading Spider-Man. Thus, Mumia missed what would have been, what should have been, the first political beating of his activist career. He made up for it by attending the rest without fail. There's one other little short thing I wanted to get in here. Injustice was abundant in the late 60s. Things were getting so bad that an out-and-out Southern racist, Governor George Wallace of Alabama, a man who had stood in a schoolhouse door vowing segregation forever, was running for president. President? Mumia was only 14, but he knew one thing. He knew that such an insult couldn't go unchallenged. He decided that he would go and protest. He managed to find three kids as rash and idealistic as himself, and they went down to the Wallace for President rally at South Philly's Spectrum Arena. Four earnest, angry, and nervous black faces in a sea of angry, resentful white faces. Faces and fists. Segregation forever. Go home, nigger. Ungawa. The boys had never found out what they meant, but they'd heard it somewhere, and they figured it meant something powerful. Go home, nigger. Black power. That did it. It was never just blacks that racist whites hated. It was black power. Suddenly, the boys were punched, kicked, and beaten. Finally, foolishly, they called out for help. Police, help, police. The police helped, all right. Here's your help, nigger. They beat the boys all over again, though this time it was done more methodically, with nightsticks and sappers, and followed up with expert kicks from heavy brogans. Then they handcuffed and arrested them for assault. The men in blue were so conscientious, so professional, so committed to their work that the four teens had to be taken to the hospital on their way to jail. Mumia had no idea how bad he looked. All he knew was that he felt tremendous relief when he saw a familiar face rushing down the emergency room corridor, looking for her son. "Mom," she glanced at him but rushed by, frowning and shaking her head. "That's not my boy," she said. He had been beaten so badly that his own mother didn't recognize him. 2 days later, at the arraignment, the judge heard the cop's testimony and he grimaced. "Assault? This kid's face assaulted your fist?" Case dismissed. It was Mumia's first police beating and his last encounter with a sympathetic judge. Now that, I won't say a whole lot about that book. I'm very proud of this book. It was a privilege to do, and I worked with Mumia on it. And I remember one line in there, I would write stuff and get it into him, and I had I told that whole, he sort of would tell me the story, tell me who to talk to, and then I'd piece it all together. And when he saw that one, the police attacked the crowds, and the gutters were running with blood. And Mumia says, no. Says they weren't running with blood. They were spattered with blood. So he kind of restrained my exaggeration. But he's never had to exaggerate.
And that was Terry Bisson. He's author of On a Move, the biography of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Again, yesterday, police attacked on Saturday a demonstration of more than 600 people in Philadelphia calling for Mumia Abu-Jamal to be taken off of death row and be given a new trial. That does it for today's program. Want to remind people that on Saturday I'll be in San Francisco at an event talking about Mumia Abu-Jamal. The event will be taking place at Mission High School in San Francisco on 18th Street and Dolores. Danny Glover will also be there. He'll be joining us in our second hour of today's program. That's 18th and Dolores on Saturday night, December 15th at Mission High School. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Brad Simpson, with help from Lizzie Ratner and Suganya Mahendra. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for the exclusive count of the Afghan casualties. That's democracynow.org. Thanks to our satellite uplink engineer, Amy Pomerleau at KPFA, everyone at KPFA and KFCF in Fresno, all our Pacifica affiliate stations airing us. We are Pacifica. Special thanks to Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Sunar, our hosts, broadcasting on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 on Dish Network. You can also hear us on public access TV stations around the country. In New York, it's Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channels 34 and 56. We are broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band of the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile. Payback time. In today's Democracy Now! Exclusive, the U.S. has killed over 3,700 Afghan civilians. That surpasses the number of people believed dead at the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Then, actor and activist Danny Glover speaks on Pacifica World AIDS Day and the organization TransAfrica. And this weekend, a rally for Mumia Abu-Jamal in Philadelphia is attacked by police. At least 7 people are arrested and charged with felony assault and riot. 3 demonstrators are hospitalized. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-Taliban forces launched a three-pronged ground attack today on eastern Afghanistan's White Mountains. A senior anti-Taliban officer said U.S. planes had quit bombing to avoid hitting their allies on the ground. U.S. warplanes killed three Mujahideen fighters in the region on Saturday night. It was the third so-called friendly fire incident in 8 days. Meanwhile, disagreements between Mujahideen commanders at the front boiled over in a tense confrontation in which soldiers from rival groups brandished their guns, took up firing positions in front of one another's headquarters. Two senior Taliban defectors were among 20 people killed in a helicopter crash in northern Afghanistan Saturday. The two were renowned ethnic Pashtun leaders. Supporters believe the Northern Alliance deliberately crashed the helicopter to kill the leaders. The alliance says it was an accident. The Bush administration says that U.S. military forces or CIA personnel working in Jalalabad have discovered a videotape of Osama bin Laden. They say the tape shows bin Laden recounting how he listened to news reports on the radio of the first plane crashing into the World Trade Center 3 months ago and quickly told others around him there will be more as he awaited the second attack. They say the tape also shows bin Laden admitting that many of the hijackers apparently had not known they were on suicide missions. But a debate has broken out within the administration on whether to release the video. Many in the White House argue it will bolster the case to the Arab world that bin Laden planned the attacks and portray him as cold-blooded. Others say that many in the Arab world would find the discovery of the tape too convenient and charge it was a creation of the CIA and Hollywood collaborators. A senior official admitted the tape's quality is not good and the images are dark. A final decision on the video will be taken by Karen Hughes, President Bush's close advisor, who leads a communications unit jointly set up by Britain and the United States to conduct the PR war against the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Afghanistan's new interim leader, Hamid Karzai, claims he brokered successful talks between two rival factions in the city of Kandahar yesterday morning. The city has been overtaken by infighting just days after it fell to anti-Taliban forces. Two rival commanders are in control of separate sections of the city. The road to the city is said to be littered with dead bodies and the remains of smashed cars. Aid agencies say there are already 15 checkpoints set up by rival groups. Several aid convoys passed through, but all said they were robbed of their humanitarian supplies. The Israeli army launched a nighttime raid on the Arab village of Anabta, shooting dead four policemen, setting fire to one house and dynamiting another and arresting several dozen residents. Residents said soldiers forced men from the village to strip to their underwear and stand in the street while the buildings were searched. Several men showed their hands on which their names and house numbers had been written in indelible ink by their interrogators, red for suspects' families, green for neighbors of suspects. And the UN Human Rights Commissioner, Mary Robinson, criticized the Bush administration plan to set up military tribunals, saying they skirt democratic guarantees. She said the safeguards, including the right to a fair trial, must be upheld even in times of crisis. And this news from New York City, after a heated city council hearing Thursday and angry protests by one of New York's largest unions, the Giuliani administration has decided to scrap plans to hire the Bechtel Group to take over control of the World Trade Center cleanup. The announcement came this weekend after more than 4 weeks of secret negotiations and seemed to surprise the San Francisco multinational. Had it won the contract, the company stood to earn as much as $27.5 million from the deal. It would have been the largest emergency deal of its kind in the country. Bechtel has a history of botched construction projects, poor labor practices, and forced privatization of public industries, particularly in developing countries. It's also known for its generous contributions to Republican candidates and its close ties to GOP leaders. The Zimbabwean government assailed the U.S. Congress for passing the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, which urges President Bush to deny visas and freeze the assets of, quote, those responsible for violence and breakdown of rule of law in Zimbabwe. Officials said the bill was intended to stop the government from redistributing land from the white minority to the black majority. White farmers own more than half of the fertile land in the country. And Robert Fisk, the reporter for the British newspaper The Independent and a frequent contributor to Democracy Now!, was beaten up this weekend. The headline of his piece after he got back to Pakistan was "My Beating by Refugees as a Symbol of the Hatred and Fury of This Filthy War." Robert Fisk writes, They started by shaking hands. We said, Salaam Alaikum, peace be upon you. Then the first pebbles flew past my face. A small boy tried to grab my bag, then another, then someone punched me in the back. Then young men broke my glasses, began smashing stones into my face and head. I couldn't see for the blood pouring down my forehead and swamping my eyes, and even then I understood. I couldn't blame them for what they were doing. In fact, if I were the Afghan refugees of Qila Abdullah, close to the Afghan-Pakistan border, I would have done just the same to Robert Fisk or any other Westerner I could find. So why record my few minutes of terror and self-disgust under assault near the Afghan border, pleading and crying like an animal, when hundreds, let us be frank and say thousands, of innocent civilians are dying under American airstrikes in Afghanistan, when the war of civilization is burning and maiming the Pashtuns of Kandahar and destroying their homes because good must triumph over evil? Robert Fisk goes on to say some of the Afghans in the little village had been there for years. Others had arrived desperate and angry and mourning their slaughtered loved ones over the past few weeks. It was a bad place for a car to break down, a bad time just before iftar, the end of the daily fast of Ramadan. But what happened to us was symbolic of the hatred and fury and hypocrisy of this filthy war, a growing band of destitute Afghan men, young and old, who saw foreigners, enemies in their midst, and tried to destroy at least one of them. Edwin Starr, Stop the War Now, all that on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Richard Lloyd Perry wrote in last week's Independent from Kama'adu, Afghanistan, quote, "The village where nothing happened is reached by a steep climb at the end of a rattling three-hour drive along a stony road. Until nothing happened here, early on the morning of Saturday and again the following day, it was a large village with a small graveyard. But now that has been reversed. The cemetery on the hill contains 40 freshly dug graves, unmarked and identical, and the village of Kama'adu has ceased to exist. Many of the homes here are just deep conical craters in the earth. The rest are cracked open, split like crushed cardboard boxes. At the moment when nothing happened, the villagers of Kama'adu were taking their early morning meal before sunrise and the beginning of the Ramadan fast. And there in the rubble, dented and ripped, are tokens of the simple daily lives they led. A contorted tin kettle turned almost inside out by the blast, a collection of charred cooking pots and the fragments of an old-fashioned pedal-operated sewing machine. A split metal chest contained scraps of children's clothes and cheap, bright nylon. In another room are the only riches that these people had, six dead cows lying and distended by decay. And all this is very strange because on Saturday morning, when American B-52s unloaded dozens of bombs that killed 115 men, women, and children, nothing happened. We know this because the U.S. Department of Defense told us so. That evening, a Pentagon spokesman questioned about reports of civilian casualties in eastern Afghanistan, explained they were not true because the U.S. is meticulous in selecting only military targets associated with Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. Subsequent Pentagon utterances on the subject have wobbled somewhat, but there has been no retraction of that initial decisive statement. It just didn't happen. Well, the Pentagon most recent response to what happened on that day, the day that nothing happened, is that the bombs fell right on top of, quote, what we're calling military targets. Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld denied a press report headlined Pentagon Avoids Subject of Civilian Deaths. He said that it is difficult to get accurate figures of civilian casualties due to the disorder that reigns in the country. He said one of war's unpleasant realities is that innocent bystanders are sometimes caught in the crossfire. Incredibly, Rumsfeld himself made the analogy to the September 11th attacks, pointing to the difficulty of obtaining accurate casualty figures for the attacks on the World Trade Center. Those figures, he said, have changed as reported by the press from about 10,000 deaths at the time of the attacks to some, well, just more than 3,000 today. With the Pentagon's obstruction and the mainstream U.S. media's whiteout of the issue, it's extremely difficult for people in this country to get a sense of the number of people the U.S. has killed since the bombing of Afghanistan began on October 7th. And one professor has done something about it. Professor Mark Harold is at the University of New Hampshire. He scoured newswires and major newspapers from all over the world, combined this information with firsthand accounts, and has just put it all together into a single report. He's releasing his findings today on Democracy Now! in Exile. Since October 7th, he reports over 3,700 civilians have been killed in Afghanistan by U.S. bombs. Professor Mark Harold joins us from New Hampshire now. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us again for the second hour. This news is extremely important, despite what some say at Fox and even NPR, comments of people like Mara Liasson about casualties not being news, innocent civilians being killed, because that's what war is. Can you talk about how you came to arrive at the figures you've had, and when you started counting?
Well, I started on the first night, which was October 7th to 8th, which was actually a rather bad night for the average Afghan. A fair number of people died on that night. I then chronicled literally day by day what I was able to get a hold of. Some days I have no reports, and yet I specific reports, though we know that there was heavy bombing going on in different parts of Afghanistan. So what I did is I used figures reported by official news agencies, everything from Agence France-Presse to the Afghan Islamic Press, BBC, and such, from news reporters who visited the scene, from eyewitnesses, survivor reports. There are a number of reports which have come out by distinguished NGOs, RAVA, the Afghan Women's Association, a Italian medical group called Emergency Italia. There are major news stories in reputable national journals abroad. And one of the things I did is I did not make any judgment about the relative reliability of one nation's news agencies and reporters versus another. My assumption is that reporters, news story editors, national level media outlets try their very best to accurately report what is happening. And you did mention before the names of Robert Fisk and Richard Lloyd Perry. Both of them have really done an exemplary job, and there are others too who have done really very, very fine reporting. Kathy Gannon for the AP, and a number of other people, including a Pakistani, Behrouz Khan, who writes for a Pakistani journal. So that's basically what I did. I tried to get cross-corroboration for the events, and in most cases was able to do that. And the more detail which was provided by a particular report, the greater reliability I gave to it. So that's basically the way I've proceeded here.
Let's talk about what you call 7 days in ignominy.
Well, these are seven particularly bad days in the war on what I believe really has been, it was not the intention, I think, but it has been a war on the Afghan people. On October 11th, a small farming village northeast of Jalalabad called Karam was repeatedly bombed. 45 of the 60 mud houses were destroyed, killing at least 160 civilians. On October 18th, the central marketplace of Kandahar, in the Madad district of Kandahar was bombed and resulted in 47 civilian deaths. The target was a government building located right next to the central market. This is in downtown Kandahar. On October 23rd, in the early a.m. hours, low-flying AC-130 gunships reportedly strafed the farming villages of Bori Shokar and Chaukar Karez, located 25 miles north of Kandahar, killing 93 civilians. On this particular case, there's some very detailed accounts of by individuals who survived, and they're really horrific accounts of being strafed in the nighttime by AC-130 gunships. On November 10th, the villages of Shah Aga and a neighboring village in the poppy-growing Kakraz district was bombed, resulting in anywhere from 100 to 300 casualties. The figure I used was 125. And the seventh day was the one you referred to earlier, and that is the day it just did not happen. And this was the bombing of Kama'ado in the White Mountains of eastern Jalalabad, southeastern Jalalabad. And these are not particularly unusual days. If one looks at the 61 days for which I have data, the individual civilian casualty counts by incident are smaller, but the total per day is very close to what was reported for these 7 days of ignominy, as I call them.
We're talking to Professor Mark Harold. He is a professor of economics and women's studies at the University of New Hampshire. So as a professor of women's studies, why are you doing this count in Afghanistan?
Well, my area is really of research and teaching here, where I've been here for now 25 years, has been third world economic and social development. I've actually am working on a larger project of economic and social development in Afghanistan over the course of the 20th century. Many of the victims, it turns out, of the bombing attacks, particularly in the early days, the first 3 weeks, have been women and children. When the U.S., U.K. bombers attacked military installations, small military installations located in urban areas. The reason those military installations were in urban areas is that this was the legacy of the Civil War during the 1980s between the Mujahideen and the Soviet-backed government at the time, which controlled the urban areas and therefore put its military garrisons in urban areas. And these garrisons were then inherited by the post-Soviet government. So it's the attacking of smaller military garrisons spread out across Afghanistan by fighter bombers. These are not attacks by B-52s, which have destroyed individual homes. Part of it is because of the power of the blast. Part of it is because, although I don't think this plays a big role, I think only about 10% of the instances are due to so-called human error, as the Pentagon likes to call it, or malfunctioning equipment or something of that sort. Many of the residences which are hit are places, of course, where people are living. The average family size in Afghanistan is higher than the family size here. Data indicates that a woman has six children, and many of these houses were the residences of children, and women, of course, were at home. So the casualties include a very, very large number of women and children.
Professor Harold, I'm looking at a Fair Action alert. It says network news outlets have reported stories about civilian casualties in Afghanistan with caution, often noting Taliban claims nearly impossible to verify. But many outlets show no inclination to be equally careful when evaluating Pentagon's line on casualties. CNN, for example, has ordered reporters to frame reports of civilian deaths with reminders that the Pentagon has repeatedly stressed it's trying to minimize such casualties. host of Fox News Channel's special report with Britt Hume, recently wondered why journalists should bother covering civilian deaths at all. "The question I have," said Hume, "is civilian casualties are historically, by definition, a part of war, really. Should they be as big news as they've been?" Mara Liasson from National Public Radio was direct. "No, look, war is about killing people," she said. "Civilian casualties are unavoidable." Liasson added she thought what was missing from TV coverage was, quote, "a message from the U.S. government that says we're trying to minimize them, but the Taliban isn't, and is putting their tanks and mosques and themselves among women and children." Fox pundit and U.S. News World and Report columnist Michael Barone echoed Hume's earlier remarks. He said, "I think the real problem here is that this is poor news judgment on the part of some of those news organizations. Civilian casualties are not, as Mara says, news. The fact is they accompany war." Your comment?
Well, I think that there are a number of things which could be said here, and they're actually addressed in a longer research report which accompanies the tabulation. The first thing is that the war has been presented to the American people as a techno-video war in which smart bombs always hit their targets. In other words, the bad guys die and none of the good guys do. And what I've been trying to do here is show that that really is not true. There are a significant number of civilian casualties. Let me just maybe go back just for a moment historically. At the turn of the last century in wars, the civilian-military casualty ratio was about 80%, 80 to 90% military casualties, and 10% were civilian. By the middle of the last century, in the wars such as Korea, the Second World War, and certainly Vietnam, the ratio was inverted, and it was 80% or maybe even 90% civilian and 10% military. And what we see, I think, unfolding in Afghanistan is a reversion to somewhere between those two extremes, where about 50-50 is my best estimate as to the ratio of civilian versus military. So the first point is really that it is simply untrue that the smart bombs are smart. The carnage on the ground is awesome, is amazing, and the firsthand reports are quite eloquent testimony to that effect. I think the second point I'd make is that it is very important for the American people to hear about the extent of civilian damage. 3,700 people in Afghanistan amount to about 37,000 people in the United States, given that the population of Afghanistan is one-tenth that of the United States. This is a very significant figure, and by the way, my estimates are really underestimates. Many times I have data which just says scores of civilian killed, or many killed, or dozens killed. I don't even record those. So the true count is probably up around 5,000, which in our terms would be 50,000, which is the military death count for the United States, U.S. military casualties in Vietnam. This from the point of view of people on the ground living in Afghanistan is a very, very significant and deep tragedy. And I think Robert Fisk was absolutely correct in what he wrote and you cited on the top end of this report.
Well, Professor Mark Harold, I want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to see the dossier and civilian victims of United States aerial bombing of Afghanistan, a comprehensive accounting, you can go to our website at democracynow.org and it'll link you to the full report. Professor Harold, professor in the departments of economics and women's studies at Whitmore School of Business and Economics at the University of New Hampshire. And we urge our listeners and viewers to call the mainstream networks and tell them to pick up this story. Professor Mark Harold, who's been working 14 hours a day from October 7th, putting together the numbers of casualties and the bombing of Afghanistan. We certainly consider its news now. As he says, by conservative estimates, over 3,700, believes more around 5,000 people killed in Afghanistan so far. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. for every man, Minnie Riperton. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, just last week, actor and activist Danny Glover spoke at a Los Angeles fundraiser for Democracy Now! in Exile. More than 1,000 people attended. As you know, here at the War and Peace Report, Pacifica Radio suspended our staff without pay August 14th, and we've still been broadcasting around the country. In fact, increasing to do cable access TV, direct satellite, dish network television, and we are continuing to broadcast on Pacifica affiliates around the country, as well as on Pacifica station KPFA, though we are banned on the other four Pacifica stations. Just weeks before the fundraiser, and as Democracy Now! Reported on the War and Peace Report, the Pacifica National Board of Directors met outside Washington, D.C. in Pentagon City and unanimously voted to resign and to reconstitute themselves with a majority from the Pacifica reform movement. To date, though, the resolution, the unconditional return of Democracy Now! To the air at the four Pacifica stations on which we've been banned, has yet to be implemented. According to sources on the Pacifica Board, the network's current debt is around $4 million of a $10.8 million foundation, more than half of which can be attributed to the board's attorneys that they've hired from very much the corporate sector and public relations consultants like West Hill Partners that represented Brown and Williamson, the tobacco company. The founder, John Scanlon, represented them against the whistleblower, Jeffrey Wigan, made famous by the movie The Insider, also represented Bob Kerry against charges of the massacre in Vietnam. Well, Democracy Now! In Exile, continuing to do this broadcast, invited Danny Glover to join us. And he joined us on December 1st at the Los Angeles fundraiser. He was speaking on World AIDS Day. And this is what he had to say in the speech and then the interview I did with him afterwards.
Let me say that I'm a listener to KPFA in San Francisco. Out of Berkeley, I've been a listener so long and a supporter so long, I don't know what to do without it. It's been invaluable. Pacifica has been invaluable to my own growth. My own growth as a young man working with African Liberation Support Committee, it was invaluable to my understanding and development Pacifica was. Not as an actor, as a human being. I heard the stories of Asians. I heard the stories of Native Americans. I've heard the stories, the key element. I'm a storyteller. That's what I do. That's what I make my living doing. And I heard those stories. I was moved by those stories. I was moved by those stories to action. We need information. We need dialogue. We need information that propels us into action. More than any time, there's nobody in there. More than any one time. We need that. We need to get up in the morning and know that we're going to hear something that's going to move us in a direction that's going to move us into action. Action, the action of change. Pacifica has been that. It cannot be any other. It cannot be anything but that. We got to struggle. This is about who's going to control information. That's all it's about. You don't buy information. You can't pay for information. The information that Pacifica brings comes from people's heart, comes from people who are working with people, seeing people, telling their stories from the grassroots. That's the information we need. That's the information we need. When I was at the World Conference Against Racism, I saw people from around the world who come to put their issues at the table, to tell their stories at the table. I was so shocked that Pacifica wasn't there. Pacifica was not there. Amy and I did it. We did an interview. We did an interview with Reverend Jesse Jackson. But Pacifica wasn't there. We need that more than ever. The world is in so much trouble. What has happened? What has happened? We need to redouble our energy more than ever now. This promised to be the most difficult moment that has ever happened in my life. And it promises to be, from so many of you who've been in the struggle much longer than I have, this has promised to be something more difficult than you've ever experienced. And we need that information right now. We need to talk about new relationships. We need to talk about, as Brother Ron said, we need to talk about new relationships that are based on respect, that new relationships that are based on compassion, and new dialogue that's based upon understanding. We need that now. And we cannot do it without Pacifica. It cannot happen without Pacifica. And Pacifica is simply an organ. It's the organ. It's the facilitator for that dialogue. You are the dialogue right here. The world is the dialogue. Our communities, which are in despair and are desperate, that's the dialogue. And we need that. We need that dialogue desperately right now. We need that dialogue. That dialogue, whether we're talking about the WTO, whether we're talking about the neoliberal policies that have devastated the world, whether we're talking about AIDS in the world, AIDS in the African-American community, AIDS in the world, the emerging AIDS pandemic that's happening all over the world. We need Pacifica to be there. When we talk about the issues of indigenous people around the world, we need Pacifica to be there. When we talk about the issues of women in the world, we need Pacifica to be there. We need them to be there. It will not happen, and we have to fight. This is going to be a fight. When we talk about the death penalty in this world, in this country, we need Pacifica to be there. When we talk about the prison industrial complex in this country, we need Pacifica to be there. We need it. This is not my fight. I'm an African American standing up here. It's all of our fight. We come together here, all together, knowing that we have no option but to fight. There's no options left, you know? There's no options left. There's them, which is the mass media, plus NPR. You know what I'm saying? You know, plus them, and there are us. There are no options, really. I mean, there are no options. I can go on and talk, and you know the stories. I don't know if I'm preaching to the choir, then we have to preach to the choir, because the choir has to go out there and get some more choir members, okay? If I'm preaching to the choir, then the choir has to go out there and convert something, you know? Because we need to do the work right now. We need to do the organizing right now. And
you're listening to the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now in Exile. We're actually in Los Angeles at an event celebrating the return of Pacifica to its original mission, and we hope that'll happen soon. I'm Amy Goodman here with actor and activist Danny Glover, who has graced us with his presence at this event where there are many KPFK listeners who look forward to one day soon hearing Democracy Now! Again. But we're also here on this day, on World AIDS Day. And yeah. Danny, why were you in Los Angeles?
Well, I was involved with an award ceremony of heroes, African Americans who for years have been activists in the community, in their communities in the fight against AIDS, whether they've been supporting patients or whether they've been on the legislative front or wherever they've been supporting and fighting for fighting and doing the work that has to be done with respect to the AIDS and African-American community. And it's so critical right now. We talk about Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. We talk about the emerging crisis in China and India and Russia and all the world. But the African-American community has been, it's hard hit by the whole crisis of AIDS, the pandemic of AIDS. 43% of all new cases come from the African-American community. 28% of those come from the Latino community. So we're seeing a reemergence. You know, one third of young gay African-Americans are HIV, new African-American, young gays are HIV positive. So in this sense, the event was to not only celebrate what they had done in the past and what they are currently doing, but also to redouble our efforts, to really redouble our efforts in seeking more funds and also drawing more attention to the issue.
You're the Goodwill Ambassador for the United Nations Development Program.
Yeah.
Also, yes, taking over the chairmanship of Trans Africa.
Yeah.
Randall Robinson has left.
Well, Randall Robinson, who is the director, had been the president of Trans Africa, founder of Trans Africa, and set Trans Africa in motion and moving in a way in the fight against apartheid, and also the reinstitution of democracy in Haiti. Is stepping down, but that's at the same time sad for us to see Randall move on in the position. But also, it's inspiring in another way because at some point in time we need new leadership, and most often we hope that that's young leadership. And I think that that Trans Africa is going to be in a very good place because the work is still there. No matter what we've done in the past, no matter how we've positioned ourselves in the past, the work in the present is still there. We still have the issues of AIDS in the world. We still have the issues of inequity and economic injustice in the world. And we still and where we find that taking place, it's specifically in places like Africa, in places like the Caribbean, and in places like South America. There's a war on drugs that's happening in our community, and yet another war on drugs that is happening in Colombia. Afro-Colombians are most victimized by the war on drugs. And we've put over $1 billion into funding the Colombian government to so-called, quote-unquote, fight the war on drugs. So these issues have to be brought to the table. The tragedy of the September 11th incident has brought new attention to the models, the economic development models around the world. You know, if tourism becomes the basis of hard currency for your country, then certainly tourism, which had already been on the decline, has even gone on a steeper decline. So these are the kind of issues that Trans Africa has to deal with, and certainly the major issue that seems to be certainly obliterated from the mass media in this country is the issue of reparations. People in the world are talking about reparations, whether they're Senegalese, whether they're Afro-Brazilians, whether they're Afro-Colombians, whoever they're talking about reparations, as well as, so it's another issue. So those issues are still there in a world where people are becoming richer still, and at the same time, majority of the people are becoming poorer. Yeah, over half of the world is been marginalized over the last 50 years. Over half of the world, and Trans Africa needs to address that issue and to form the kind of broad coalitions that we need. When we talk about what the WTO is doing, when we talk about the World Bank and structural adjustments and the impact it has on the fight against AIDS, the impact it has on building an infrastructure in a country, the impact that it has on development in those countries. Those tables now. So we have an opportunity here, given the issues of given what happened September 11th, but we're going to have to fight hard, and we're going to have to have the organs to fight to hear our voices, such as Democracy Now.
And that is Danny Glover speaking at a Los Angeles fundraiser for Democracy Now in Exile. He'll be joining us again on Saturday night in San Francisco at Mission High School at 18th and Dolores, speaking about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Danny Glover, that's Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. on December 15th. I'll be out there along with a number of other people. And you can find more information out on our website at democracynow.org. And speaking of Mumia Abu-Jamal, It's been 20 years since Mumia Abu-Jamal went to prison. On December 9th, 1981, Mumia Abu-Jamal was driving a cab through the streets of Philadelphia. He came upon 13th and Locust, where he says William Faulkner, a police officer, was beating up his brother, William Cook. What happened next is in dispute. What's undisputed is that both he and the officer were shot, and the officer died. What's in dispute is who killed Daniel Faulkner. Mumia says it was someone else. Several witnesses saw another shooter flee. Mumia's legally registered 38 was never decisively linked to Faulkner's wounds. Mumia Abu-Jamal was tried and sentenced to death in 1982. He's been on death row ever since. This weekend in Philadelphia, a major rally for him. Police attacked the rally. A number of people were arrested. Three were hospitalized. Before we find out what happened there, we're going to go to a most recent commentary of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Why does the war begin? That is, as the saying goes, one of those $64,000 questions, as Mama used to say. For there are as many answers as there are wars. Consider the Vietnam War, which raged for over a decade, leaving over 2 million Vietnamese and over 60,000 Americans dead, as well as a nation ecologically ravaged. On August 2nd, 1964, according to American press reports, North Vietnamese coastal guards attacked two U.S. destroyers sailing in the Gulf of Tonkin. Within a week, the U.S. Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, granting the president war powers, and the Vietnam War was launched. Years later, after the fires of war cooled to ashes, we learned that the press reports that sparked this carnage were lies. Former CIA Chief John Stockwell would later write in his remarkable The Praetorian Guard, quote, after midnight on July 30th, 1964, Norwegian-built Swiss or Nasties manned with CIA crews attacked the North Vietnamese radar station on Hon Mae Island and bombarded Hong Nhu in the Gulf of Tonkin. The North Vietnamese sent a formal protest to the United States. The frigate USN Maddox, which was patrolling inside North Vietnamese waters to provide cover for CIA marauders, remained on station. Clearly provoked and pursuing the CIA marauders, North Vietnamese moved to challenge the Maddox. The Maddox fired first. The Vietnamese answered with torpedoes that missed. A garbled version of the incident, blaming the North Vietnamese, was trumpeted through a cooperative media to the U.S. public and was used to justify formal moves by Lyndon Johnson to launch the Vietnam War, which had been in open planning stages for 2 years. The rest is history, unquote, page 81. It has been a history written in blood, gore, and genocidal death. That, however, was then. What about now? All American eyes are now focused on Afghanistan, the land ravaged by over 8 years of war with the former Soviet Union. Again, according to the media, the U.S. entered the country in response to the Soviet incursion to aid the beleaguered Mujahideen, right? In 1988, former U.S. National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski granted an interview to the French newspaper Le Nouveau Observateur, stating that the U.S. CIA was in Afghanistan months before the Soviets. He told the reporter, quote, according to the official version of history, CIA aid to the Mujahideen began during 1980, after the Soviet army invaded Afghanistan, 24th of December, 1979. But the reality, secretly guarded until now, is completely otherwise. Indeed, it was July 3rd, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. The reporter asked, you don't regret anything today? Brzezinski answered, regret what? The secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap. And you want me to regret it? Unquote. the Afghan trap led to over 2 million Afghan deaths, 6 million Afghans sent into exile, and 20,000 Soviet troop casualties. Provocations, inducements, media manipulations, traps, spies, covers. Millions dead, millions exiled. Why does a war begin? As Mama used to say, boy, that's the $64,000 question. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back on the latest in his case and what happened at the protests the police attacked in Philadelphia in a minute. Sing Sing Prison Blues by Bessie Smith here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Saturday, over 600 people gathered in the streets of Philadelphia to try to stop the execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal to call for a new trial for the death row prisoner. Police attacked the legally permitted demonstration. According to organizers, seven people were arrested, charged with felony assault and riot. Two of those were released yesterday without charges or bail, but those not released have bonds ranging from $8,000 to $100,000. Three demonstrators were hospitalized with injuries, including a fractured tailbone, concussion, internal bleeding, severe abrasion. Miles Soleil was at the protest. He's with Refuse and Resist. What happened, Miles?
On Saturday, over 600 people, overwhelmingly youth, gathered in Philadelphia to not only acknowledge 20 stolen years for Mumia Abu-Jamal's life, but also as a tribute of 20 years of resistance to Mumia. And in an unprecedented thing, I've been in Philadelphia every summer for Mumia since 1995. I've never seen the Philadelphia police or anybody viciously attack a demonstration like they did on Saturday, with guns drawn, billy clubs to people's bodies, and macing people in the faces. I was maced, and many others were maced. They attacked this demonstration, arrested people, arrested a very diverse cross-section of who was at the demonstration. It did something that we've seen in Seattle, did stuff that we've seen in Genoa, did what we've seen in Prague, and people were really defiant, and people were very bold. Our generation, Mumia Abu-Jamal has been on death row for as long as I've been alive, and there was many people my age and even younger who were out there very much with the spirit of defiance and the spirit of resistance of Mumia, and were not backing down on
Saturday.
What
did police do?
Well, they first came and they attacked the middle of the march, and the middle of the march was where it started being primarily youth. They came out with billy clubs and they rode their bikes from the sidewalks right into the march.
The police.
The police did, and they started beating people. They had people in chokeholds. They started screaming, "I'm going to kill you," to different people, and they started macing people. They were then surrounded by many protesters, at which point more police officers came in, arrested people, had a few police officers had guns drawn, and they were beating people pretty viciously. And this is something that we haven't seen happen in Philadelphia from Mumia, and I think that my position on this is that we need to see this as not only an attack on those who stepped out on Saturday, but this is part of their moves and their plans to go forward with executing Mumia. And if we're going to actually stop Mumia's execution and free him, we need to defend those who have come under attack for stepping out for him.
In our first hour, we spoke to Ao, who was one of the protesters with International Concern Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. She has a fractured tailbone and a sprained neck. We're also joined in the studio by Clark Kissinger, who spent time in jail because of the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal as he continues to protest. He also is with Refuse and Resist. Tom Ridge, who is the governor of Pennsylvania until recently when he became head of Homeland Security, signed two death warrants for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Can you talk about, now that he's been elevated, whether you see the way the police dealt with protesters on Saturday as a new phase of since September 11th of the way police are dealing in this country, and specifically with Mumia Abu-Jamal?
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, basically, I think what you saw on Saturday was is that the police are feeling unleashed by the new climate of repression that's going on in the country. And if you actually track what happened in terms of the new court decisions in Mumia's case and what has been going on nationally, that is the signing of the USA Patriot Act, the roundups, the appointing of Tom Ridge to be the Obersturmbannführer for Homeland Security, the setting up of the secret military tribunals by Bush, the passing of the new regulations saying that they can listen in on conversations between lawyers and their clients. This tracks a series of decisions that have also happened in the courts against Mumia during this period of time. And I think that what we have to see is that Mumia's case is entering a dangerous new phase right now. Because just as after the 1995 bombing of the Murrow Building in Oklahoma, they put through the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that made it so much harder for inmates on death row to have their cases reviewed in the federal courts, now we have this whole new repressive climate. And at the same time, Judge Yon, who is the judge that has been assigned Mumia's habeas appeal, has said that he is not going to grant a stay, that is, he's not going to allow any more delays while Mumia has his new evidence heard and fully judged by the Pennsylvania courts. He still has a whole other appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and the federal judge is saying, I don't care, I'm not going to be bound by that, I'm going to proceed.
Can you explain the latest, though, in the case of the state judge, Demby, for those who didn't hear over Thanksgiving when she threw out his case?
That's right. Mumia went back in and asked for a new PCRA hearing in the state of Pennsylvania as a post-conviction relief hearing because of all of the new evidence that has come forward, affidavits by new witnesses, including one person who said that he is the person that actually shot Officer Faulkner. And Judge Demby denied that, and she denied it on the basis of a law that was only passed in 1995, setting up a 60-day time limit for new evidence. In other words, the state says, look, we can wait 20 years to bring a murder prosecution against somebody, but if an inmate on death row comes upon new evidence that can potentially show that they're free, they have only 60 days to get that into court. That puts deadlines ahead of justice but it's just symptomatic of the whole a new repressive atmosphere that's going on, and her refusal to do that was basically followed what Judge Yon, the federal judge, had said when he turned down taking depositions from these witnesses. He even suggested that the state not do it. So people may think, well, look, the state's not going to move on Mumia right now because they have more important things to do. They have other problems. You know, Mumia is actually one of their problems. He's somebody who has written persuasively against the war on Afghanistan from his death cell. He's turned his death cell into a tribune of the people against injustice and war. He's written three books, over 450 weekly columns, and they want to shut him down. And as Mumia has said many times, they don't just want my death, they want my silence.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Clark Kissinger with Refuse and Resist, the latest on Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. We will continue to follow this. And again, on Saturday night, we'll be out in San Francisco with Danny Glover to talk more about his case. People can find out more about that at our website, democracynow.org. We're going to end today's program with a young person who is just about to go into a news conference. The National Youth and Student Peace Coalition is being launched in a few minutes against war in Washington, D.C. Coalition members are holding a news conference to speak out on the potentially unending war on terror. We're joined by John Brett, a student at Dartmouth College and member of Campus Greens. Can you tell us what you're about to do right now in Washington?
Yes, the National Youth and Student Peace Coalition is about ready to kick off our national efforts to bring students representing a variety of constituencies from around the country together to make our voices heard and our concerns registered as they relate to U.S. Response post September 11th.
And you're holding this at the National Japanese American Memorial?
That's correct. We're right across from the Capitol building at the Japanese American Memorial to Patriotism.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We're going to find out more about this after you have your news conference again today, the National Japanese American Memorial, the site of a new coalition that's being announced, the National Youth and Student Peace Coalition. John Brett of Dartmouth and Campus Greens, thanks for being with us. And that does it for today's report. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner, Saganya Mahendran. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org. You can also hear us at webactive.com and go to our website for all links at democracynow.org. Jackie Suin is our webmeister. Thanks to our satellite uplink engineer, Amy Pomerlo at KPFA, everyone at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno, to all the Pacifica affiliate stations who are airing us around the country. We are Pacifica. Thanks to Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno, broadcasting also on Free Speech TV channel 9415 of the Dish Network, on Manhattan Neighborhood Network channels 34 and 56, on public access cable stations around the country. And by the way, we are broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. A very happy birthday to Chris Abrams, our producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Dream is clear.